The author devotes 20 pages to a historical sketch of federal involvement in child support collection. It began not as a response to any widespread problem of parental abandonment, but to political pressure from feminist groups and bar associations. President Ford somewhat reluctantly signed legislation creating the Office of Child Support Enforcement in 1975, warning that it was an unwarranted federal intrusion into families and the role of the states. The original rationale was that the government would save on welfare payments to unmarried mothers by getting the fathers to pay more. Critics pointed out at the time that most welfare mothers did not even have child support orders, and that most of the fathers were too poor in any case to pay what the mothers received in welfare benefits. In 1988, Congress passed the Family Support Act with two key provisions. The first, states were required to implement presumptive and virtually compulsory child support guidelines, and the second, the use of criminal enforcement machinery was extended from welfare cases to all child support orders. Non-welfare fathers are both far more numerous and wealthier than the fathers of welfare babies originally targeted. Today, non-welfare fathers account for 83% of child support cases, a proportion which continues to grow, and 92% of the money collected. Yet there has never been a serious problem of non-payment on the part of these men. Since 1988, increasing revenue has been the real aim of the program, and the supposed need to force deadbeats to support their children has never been anything but a hoax intended to confuse the public. Oddly, the program actually loses money at the federal level. It cost taxpayers $2.7 billion in 2002, for example, and the deficit continues to increase. This money gets paid out to state officials as an incentive to increase the amount they collect. The more they extort from fathers, the more the federal government rewards them, regardless of whether the men are guilty of anything. In 2002, for example, Ohio collected $228 million, while California got $640 million. In order to receive their cut of the swag, states are required to channel payments through their criminal enforcement machinery. In other words, they must treat all divorced fathers, even those who pay their child support in full and on time, like criminals. And they do. Officials boast of collecting so-and-so millions of dollars from deadbeats. Criminality is simply ascribed by the government to every divorced father. Current child support guidelines, Baskerville reports, are largely the creation of one man, a Dr. Robert Williams. In 1987, he founded Policy Studies Incorporated, a private consulting and collection agency targeting government contracts and child support enforcements. Simultaneously, in his capacity as a consultant for the Department of Health and Human Services, he drew up a set of model child support guidelines. Obviously, his business interests were best served by making the guidelines as onerous as possible. In Baskerville's own words, only by creating a level of obligation high enough to create hardship for fathers can the guidelines create a large enough pool of defaulters to ensure profits and demand for the services of his private collection agency. It worked. The following year, as mentioned, the Family Support Act was passed, requiring states to implement their own child support guidelines in order to qualify for federal handouts, and they were given a short time in which to draw them up. Most did the easiest thing and simply adopted Williams' own guidelines endorsed by HHS. As government began whipping up deadbeat dad hysteria, his company's earnings soared. A number of state courts have ruled against the guidelines. A Georgia Superior Court described them as contrary to common sense, since they bear no relation to the actual costs of raising children. Furthermore, they create a windfall of the obligé. The presumptive award leaves the non-custodial parent in poverty, while the custodial parent enjoys a notably higher standard of living. A Wisconsin court pointed out that the state guidelines would result in a figure so far beyond the child's needs as to be irrational. All such rulings were reversed on government appeal. Divorced fathers have their cars booted and their drivers and professional licenses revoked, which prevents them from getting or keeping employment. They routinely lose their houses, and many end up in homeless shelters, which one philosophically described as better than being in jail. Baskerville cites one case of a father being hospitalized for malnutrition because he was not left enough money to feed himself adequately. The U.S. now has a larger percentage of its population behind bars than any other nation in the world. How many of these prisoners are fathers jailed for non-payment of child support? For some reason, the Bureau of Justice Statistics will not tell us. We do know that proposals are being made for relieving prison overcrowding by constructing special detention camps for fathers. Public relations campaigns are being devised to put a more acceptable face upon what is happening. A Virginia enforcement director describes the fathers he pursues as clients and customers who are entitled to the benefits of child support services. Robert Williams' company has customer service units for fostering cooperation with each customer and specialized customer service centers for increasing responsiveness to customers. Baskerville dryly comments, "These entrepreneurs neglected to mention that customers who choose not to patronize these establishments will be arrested." In January 2000, HHS Secretary Donna Shalala proudly announced that federal and state child support enforcement program broke new records in nationwide collections in fiscal year 1999, reaching $15.5 billion, nearly double the amount collected in 1992. At the same time, collections have gone down when measured as a percentage of what the government claims fathers owe. The reason? Interest and arrearages created by Williams' guidelines are piled upon the heads of fathers faster than actual money can be squeezed out of them. Most of this fictitious debt can never be collected, of course. The domestic violence we hear so much about is essentially just another aspect of the divorce game. When a woman leaves her husband, she is routinely advised to accuse him of abuse, whether of herself or the children. No evidence is necessary. The husband is hauled off to prison and forbidden most types of contact with his family. Courts themselves sponsor seminars on how to fabricate accusations, and there are no penalties for perjury. Baskerville notes that the literature on domestic violence evinces no concern with prosecuting men directly for violent acts. Indeed, were men beating their wives, there would be no need for a special category of violence labeled domestic. They could simply be prosecuted for battery under the same laws that apply to other cases. The complaint of domestic violence activists is almost exclusively that abusers might retain custody or visitation rights for their children. They speak ominously of the batterers making threats of kidnapping. This simply means that involuntarily divorced fathers want their children back. It is important to note that terms such as abuse, violence, and battery do not, in the surreal world of feminism and divorce law, have their traditional English meanings. As early as 1979, feminists were writing of men who battered their wives by ignoring them and by working late. Today, women are instructed that abuse includes name-calling, giving you negative looks, ignoring your opinions, and, revealingly in my view, refusing to let you have money. The U.S. Department of Justice has declared that undermining an individual's sense of self-worth is domestic violence, and hence, a federal crime. The usual fate of a man charged with abuse is to receive a restraining order, sometimes called an order of protection. This is a decree issued from the bench without evidence being presented and without the man being summoned to speak in his own defense. It prohibits a wide range of otherwise legal behavior. It declares the man a criminal and subject to arrest should he continue to live peacefully in his own home or associate with his children. One law professor notes that part of the reason that order exists is to be violated. Even if no evidence exists to convict him, the protection order can provide the basis for criminal liability on the more easily proven crime of violating the order. Restraining orders are said to be doled out like candy to all who apply. Fathers who contact their children are prosecuted for stalking, an offense the government defines as any non-consensual communication. Try accusing the IRS of stalking you. Even fathers for whom child visitation rights have been established remain under restraining orders which, like tripwires, can trigger arrest for the most innocent behavior. Acts for which fathers have been charged include opening an apartment door so a 5-year-old son could ring the bell for his mother, putting a note in a son's suitcase to inform the mother he had been sick during his visit, and attending music recitals, sports events, or church services at which their children were present. Judges issue these orders because there are negative consequences for them if they do not. Federally funded feminist groups publish the names of judges who persist in trying to observe due process. A Maine judge was removed from the bench for lack of sensitivity to women applying for restraining orders. One retired judge says his colleagues see the harm being done, but remain quiet due to the political climate. Cases have gotten into the news of husbands attacking their estranged wives, despite being under a restraining order. Baskerville asks us to consider whether such men might not be attacking their wives because of the restraining orders. These tyrannical acts have much the character of a deliberate provocation. One journalist writes, "It's amazing there aren't more rampages." Of course, to feminists, this male violence simply proves the need for more restraining orders. An ideology is unfalsifiable. There are now supervised visitation centers where fathers are made to pay up to $80 an hour to see their children. "People yell at you in front of the children," says one father. "They try to degrade the father in the child's eyes. Even hugging your own children could end your visit," says another. There are cameras on the walls, and social workers armed with clipboards observe the fathers minutely. The Boston Globe reports, "Visitation centers are becoming so popular with family court judges that certain centers have waiting lists up to a year long. That has led to some visits being cut short to accommodate other families. Special integrated domestic violence courts are now being established to expedite convictions. There is no presumption of innocence. Hearsay evidence is admissible, and defendants have no right to face their accusers. One study found there was no possibility that a defendant could be found innocent, since all persons arrested received some punishment. Prosecutors pile up charges to encourage plea bargaining. In other words, innocent men plead guilty to lesser charges in an attempt to avoid having their lives ruined entirely. Battered women's shelters are another institution of the divorce industry, no longer bearing any relation to what their name appears to signify. Rather than providing first aid and other physical relief to women brutalized by their husbands, they are one-stop divorce shops. They assist women in fabricating abuse and incest allegations against their husbands and provide letters of endorsement for use against fathers in family court. Women report the use of high-pressure tactics to get them to divorce their husbands. One called a shelter an experience from hell. The message was, "You believe what we believe, you do what we say, or you get out of here." Many shelters are lesbian covens where heterosexual volunteers are forbidden to discuss their wedding plans with co-workers. The great irony about the entire abuse industry is that child abuse is much more likely to occur in the fatherless homes now being created in unprecedented numbers. Sometimes it is perpetrated by the mother's new boyfriends, but very, very often by the mother herself. HHS studies report that children in mother-only households were 3 times more likely to be fatally abused, aka murdered, than children in father-only homes. Females were 78% of the perpetrators of fatal child abuse and 81% of natural parents who seriously abuse their children. One writer says, "Although as a literary theme, the good father protecting his children from the bad mother is almost unheard of, so idealized has mothering become, in real life, fathers have often played the protector role inside families." In other words, the abuse industry is depriving children of their natural protectors and fostering more abuse. Perhaps we may most appropriately conclude this very incomplete survey of divorce industry horrors by noting the effects on the children themselves. One study, based on interviews with children of divorce, reported that they, quote, "expressed the wish for increased contact with their fathers with a startling and moving intensity. The most striking response among 6 to 8-year-old children was their pervasive sadness. The impact of separation appeared so strong that the children's usual defenses and coping strategies did not hold sufficiently under stress. Crying and sobbing were not uncommon. More than half of these children missed their father acutely. Many felt abandoned and rejected by him, and expressed their longing in ways reminiscent of grief for a dead parent. In confronting the despair and sadness of these children and their intense, almost physical longing for their father, it was evident that inner psychological needs of great power and intensity were being expressed. Inevitably, there has been talk of reforming the system, not least by its beneficiaries, who speak of wanting to make it more efficient. Why we should wish to see children removed from their father's care more efficiently, they do not tell us. The government is fertile with responsible fatherhood programs, healthy marriage initiatives, defense of marriage acts, and the such like. These should fool no one who has read Dr. Baskerville's book attentively. They are nothing but further occasions for extending governmental power and patronage while deceiving the public. The next time you hear a politician promise to strengthen your marriage or family, pay no attention. What must be done is clear. In the words of columnist Kathleen Parker, the divorce industry has to be dismantled, burned, and buried like the monster it is. Now, we must consider the means for accomplishing this. One researcher reports being told the same thing in several cities. Shoot the judges and lawyers. A few men do more than talk. Statistics are scarce. Why? But judges and lawyers nationwide agree from all the stories they hear about fatal shootings, bombings, knifings, and beatings that family law is the most dangerous area in which to practice, reports a law journal. According to the Boston Globe, judges now carry guns under their robes to protect themselves from fathers. Baskerville asserts that metal detectors were installed in courtrooms specifically from fear of fathers. Previous attacks upon family court judges, he notes, went mostly unreported in the press. Why? But the June 2006 shooting of a Nevada judge received international attention. The full gravity of the situation is finally penetrating the public's consciousness. The author pointedly asks what judges and lawyers expect when they set about the business of taking away people's children. Indeed, he is neither exaggerating nor using metaphors when, in the book's subtitle, he describes the regime's campaign against fathers as a war. The male obligation to military service, i.e., to die or kill under certain circumstances if called upon, has traditionally been based upon a man's obligation to protect his family. The duty of national defense is derived from this, as the nation is itself derived from the family. In the author's words, this is precisely what fathers are for, to become violent when someone interferes with their children. Individual acts of revenge, heartwarming though they may be to read about, will not put an end to the system. The liquidation of the divorce regime can only be accomplished by organized political force. The criminals and parasites who make up the divorce industry have a big head start. They are highly organized, well-funded, largely by their victims, determined, and in the case of feminists, fanatical. They will fight tooth and nail to retain their wealth and power. Fathers, in contrast, are only beginning to awaken to the full extent of the situation and to organize resistance. Dr. Baskerville himself is president of one such organization, the American Coalition for Fathers and Children. His recommendations for reform are all moderate and sensible. That may be their principal failing. They include the enforcement of due process principles as enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, a presumption of joint custody, the reform of no-fault laws to require faithless women or men to take responsibility for ending the marriage contract, and holding divorce industry officials accountable for their decisions. I am unsure why divorce could not simply be abolished as a legal category. There do have to be laws to deal with cases of spousal infidelity and abandonment, of course. Columnist Lloyd Conway has formulated a simple policy for these, which I am unable to improve upon. If you want to run off with a chorus girl, go ahead. Just leave your wallet with mama. And if the milkman is making special deliveries, then the lovebirds can fill out your child support checks together. Holding divorce officials responsible for their decisions will be unnecessary when they are made responsible for punching out license plates instead. Legal custody will have less practical importance in the absence of a divorce enforcement regime. Men, I fear, will have to demand nothing less than the full re-establishment of what feminists call patriarchy, the male-headed family as the normal social unit. This may be a radical idea, given how far our society has gone off track, but it is hardly revolutionary. It is really just the radical restoration of the natural and traditional order of the human family. Baskerville doubts whether a return to father custody can find acceptance beyond the fringe of political debate. I think he is mistaken on this. There is no such thing as a fixed fringe to the political debate. One of the most important forms of political activity consists precisely in moving the fringe. It took much more determination on the part of homosexuals to get us to where gay marriage is discussed with a straight face than it would for normal men to restore the presumption of father custody. Indeed, I suspect that men, once politically united, could dictate almost any terms they wished to women. These are interesting times ahead for men. The course we must embark on is dangerous, but it is less dangerous than continuing to do nothing. F. Roger Devline, Ph.D., is an independent scholar and the author of Alexandra Kohave and the Outcome of Modern Thought, and is a frequent contributor to the Occidental Quarterly.